Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and a happy new year to all our listeners from everyone here at These Football Times. Welcome to the first episode of the second series of The Political Football. Football's a global phenomenon. People who follow it fall into the obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world, though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioning devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase power using football as a political tool. This series looks at a few examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether at times football has kicked back against these forces and provided a means to counter them. This is The Political Football, and today we'll be bringing it home and talking about politics and football in the UK, particularly in the era of the 70s. I'm Gary Thacker, and normally at this time I'd be introducing my co-host and good friend Stu Horsfield. For reasons that will become clear shortly, however, in this episode I'll be hosting alone. As this is the first episode of the new series of Political Football, we've tweaked the format a little bit. Instead of co-hosts and one guest, we have one host and co-guests. As I might number it in this episode, the big bonus for listeners is you'll hear less from me and more from the guests. For me, the bonus is that I'll be very much like a listener too, and with less talking to do, I'll be able to crack open a beer, which I've already done, and put my feet up and listen to the guys talking. And this is where Stu's absence from the co-host chair is explained. He's moved to the other side of the desk, so instead of posing questions, he'll be answering them. As well as sitting normally alongside me on the Political Football pods, Stu is a senior writer for These Football Times, has a first-class degree in PE and sports studies. He's a higher education lecturer and wrote a degree course on football coaching. He also set up a sports academy at a college where he previously worked. He has passionate views about the game we all love, especially the period around the 70s and the 80s, when the very existence of football was imperiled by hooliganism on one hand and a Conservative government on the other, both who seem to have agendas bereft of concerns for the future of the game. Hi, Stu. What's it like on the side of the desk, buddy?
I've got to say it's a little bit intimidating, if I'm honest. I'm usually quite protected where I'm sat, and I just get to interject with random questions as I actually think of them, or as, like, you know, Gary, the guests who make really good points, and it sets me thinking while I'm sat there quiet and go, oh, I think I'll ask that. I'd like to know more about that. Now I can feel a bit of pressure, not going to lie.
Okay, buddy, well, you know, let's ramp that pressure a bit. I've got some questions lined up for you, buddy.
Okay, gentle.
To compliment Stu, we also have along today Steve Scragg. Steve's already appeared on the Political Football and is often to be found on the Lob podcasts. As well as being a font of knowledge on all things football, an all-round top bloke, as Steve once described him, Steve is TFT's very own hipster of football. Hailing from Liverpool, there are many aspects of this discussion that he'll have a particular perspective on, and he's the ideal person to complete the panel, well, if two is a panel, of our guest today. How you doing, Stevie?
We're all right, Gary. How are we doing?
Oh, good, matey. I'm really looking forward to this because it's going to be really easy for me and hard work for you two guys.
Oh, no, this is just going to be like putting the world to rights down the pub, this one. So, looking forward to this massively.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, so let's kick it off then. So, Stu first, can you give me an outline of political context of what the main issues were around football in that time?
For me, it's like, it's more a social thing. We've talked about this before, how society can mirror, you know, what's happening in the world, and football can mirror what's happening in society. And I think the 70s, you know, and the 80s, I think, was almost a complete reflection of what was happening at the time in this country. I think there was, you know, a lot of civil unrest. There was a lot of, I suppose, not anger, but not really knowing what to do with how people felt. There was this pent-up frustration, pent-up aggression with how the country was feeling in general. And football seemed to be the outlet. Football seemed to be the focal point where people could almost bring their grievances grievances to bear, if you like, and it was almost a rallying point, if you like, where, you know, society could, certainly working class society could as a whole, almost come together as a collective and almost voice their opinion and use football as that vehicle. And obviously, as we know, unfortunately, sometimes it went, well, it certainly went too far. Sometimes it was taken out of context. Certainly people then started to use football as actually being the cause of the ills and not necessarily look at what was causing football fans, etc., to behave like they were. They almost decided that football was actually the cause, and it was almost completely flipped. So this mirror of that, how football fans saw society in this country, certainly late 60s, definitely into the 70s and early 80s, instead of actually looking at what was causing fans' behaviour, what was causing this unrest, it was actually flipped by a very clever, very articulate conservative government. Certainly, you know, towards the late 70s and into the 80s, it was almost flipped, and football was used actually that's the cause, this is the pinch point of where the civil unrest rises. And I think it was almost came down to a battle of, you know, who do you believe, you know, is societies in the, you know, certainly in England, the UK, you know, were societies' ills a product of football, or were they a product of the politics that were happening at the time? You know, and it came really close to almost to football almost losing, and football being actually the cause that was actually going to give way in terms of changing how society felt. And it's very much a reflection of society. And I'm a strong believer that I love football. We all love football. People, hopefully, are listening to this, you know, and us as at TFT, you know, we love the game so much. We don't want to see the ills within the game, but the game does have ills, and we've talked about them, Gary, and we've listened to some fantastic guests talk about them, but we want to love and protect the game. And I think, but during that time, I think, although I was only young at the time, I think the game came very close. We almost came close to losing the game. In this country. And I know Stephen and I chat about this, you know, quite regularly. You know, we have the same interests, a lot of the same opinions. You know, and I think there was a real moment, sort of mid-80s up to early 90s, where football was, there was a real danger that we would actually lose the game based on political power, political sway, political propaganda. And I think we were really close. Like I say, we were really, really close to losing the game as we know it now. And I'm like I say, Stephen from Liverpool, you know, Stephen will be able to add so much more to this. Being a lad from Scarborough and growing up a bit and watching football in Hull, yes, football touches every life in every town and every city, but it doesn't touch the lives anywhere like it does in Liverpool. And I know, yeah, you know, Stephen will be able to add to this. And yeah, to be fair, you only have to look at, I mean, obviously doing the course I've just been doing, you only have to look at the miners' strike and the way, you know, the way policing was done during the miners' strike, and you look at the way policing was done at football games, and it, like I say, it's just a mirror. It's a mirror image of what was going on at that time in this country.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you're saying there, Stu. Before we sort of delve into a little more detail of those points you mentioned there, I just want to get Stevie's perspective on this as well.
Oh, totally. I just echo a lot of what Stuart said there. You know, football in the 1970s and 80s, it mirrored social unease. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't football. It was just the entire social fabric of the country. You know, it was just a microcosm of how the country was going. You know, the concept of conservative rule at the time, and everything that was brought down upon the working classes, and football was for the working classes. You know, it simply mirrored life on a day-to-day basis. You know, you could walk into any major city and you would find decay, and you would find rot, you would find just social disease, but basically, you know, brought on by hardship and just chances being torn away from communities. And while this just kind of like rolled into football, and I know from a Liverpool perspective, is that that classic phrase, the managed decline of the city, of Thatcher's government. Football was a fantastic kind of way to say fuck you, basically. You know, this is us, and you know, we are brilliant at something. And it was that concept that you will not take this away from us, and we will, you know, protest in a way, you know, against social decay and just how the country was, how it was just kind of disregarded in so many ways, and football just mirrored that. You know, it was a way of just displaying what could be.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of old enough to remember those sort of days as well, and I absolutely agree with what you both said. I think we've broadly touched on 4 points. So I'm going to sort of go to each of you first, and I think the 4 points I want to sort of talk about with the historical context of the era is the firstly the rise of the football hooligan, secondly economic issues, thirdly policing, and fourthly the government policies. So I'm going to go Steve. So firstly, we used to. So football's a working class sport, obviously attracted people from the working class. Social influences on the working class would therefore be reflected in their activities and pastime. As a male-dominated sport and popularly activated, reflected through cultural change within the sections of society, from around the 1880s, known as rough fans, who attacked each other and teams and referees, football hooliganism sort of really took the head again in the 70s and late 60s, 70s and 80s, and become termed as the English disease. So, in the context of the political situation at the time, can you give us some sort of your feelings about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, Steve always talks very eloquently, doesn't he? You know, and he talks about, I know he does, it's sickening, isn't it? And, this is why I just ask questions. You know, wherever you've got disaffected people or disaffected youth, they always look for a common goal. You're always looking to belong to something. And like Stephen said, you know, the very fabric of society was being torn down, you know, as a working class. And football clubs and teams were almost the last bastions, if you like, of something to belong to and something to cling to.
That's what it was, right, Stu? Yeah. It is that concept of, you know, clinging to something or clinging to something, but you know, having some kind of outlet as to say that, you know, you can take whatever you want from us, but you will not take this. And in a similar way, it's like so many, you know, bands that emerge from deprived areas of big cities is a similar type of thing.
It is, and you're right. It's that sense of identity, and I think what happened was because as a working class, it's so difficult to mobilise against a political entity. You sort of used, you know, fans, hooligans. You know, it was a very fine line that people sort of trod, if you like, and it's that. Because you can't rally against the government and against where it's coming from, you rally against the next thing. So then, you know, the thing that you're most protective of is your club, your team, your ground. And so anybody who comes into your ground or comes to your manor, if you like, if you use the sort of the football factory terms, and that became the battleground, that became the outlet. Like Stephen said, you know, the youth at the time needed an outlet for all this frustration and this anger and this almost sense of injustice, that actually the football ground became the battleground, if you like. And instead of the government and, you know, and subsequent governments, you know, it wasn't just, you know, Thatcher wasn't in power from the early 70s, you know, it was an ongoing thing. But because government never, like I said earlier, never actually looked to the root or the source of the problem, they just tried to contain it. And the more you squeeze and contain, the more they will rally against it and the more they will fight against it. And so the worse it became. So, you know, it was the problem was, is that they never tried to get to the root of it quickly enough, or see that actually government, if you like, and social policy was actually the cause. All they did was see that football was the manifestation of it, and so decided that was the problem. So how do you control football? How do you control fans? How do you control the environment? And then football fans just saw that as even more, like Stephen said, you know, the more stripping of you're trying to take what's ours. You're now trying to take the game. You're now trying to control how we go to ground, where we go, the games we go, the trains we go on. We'll just rally and rail against that more and more. And so it just perpetuated and perpetuated and perpetuated until, you know, there were games. We look at the Luton Millwall game, which, you know, I'm sure we'll look at later on, where, at, you know, social order and social control was lost. You know, maybe only moments at a time. But there were times when they squeezed so tightly that actually they lost control because they squeezed too tightly.
Yeah, all good points there, Stu. And you sort of segued nicely into the second point I wanted to mention about the economic problems of the times and how that was that played out in with regard to football and football fans and the way the government sort of saw football fans' reaction, Stevie.
Yeah, well, completely. It was key to everything. You know, you only have to. There was this schism almost. Football has always had this us and them kind of attitude, this concept, but it was never more pronounced than then, because as a football fan, they felt that everyone was kind of like against them. You know, it wasn't just a case of the authorities, it wasn't just the police, it was the chairmen of the football club. You know, you don't have to look at Ken Bates building kind of like, you know, electric fences, you know, and stuff like that, you know, and it was that concept of, you know, we will still come and support our football club because it is our football club. And this was just rooted in, you know, the economics of the game, the economics of the country. And like we've said, football at the time, and in a way, you know, in a way that, I don't know, a contemporary fan might struggle to comprehend, was that it really did mirror day-to-day life. I mean, now you've got kind of like similar kind of political unease and unrest. I mean, this current decade has been, you know, very similar to the 1970s in many respects. You've had hung parliaments, you've had, you know, the resignations of prime ministers, you've had Brexit. You know, there were referendums on the European Union back then, you know, and it's politically as volatile now as it was in the 1970s, yet you're never going to see that translated into football stadiums now, you know, and that's one of the differences, biggest differences between now and then, and it did, you know, at that time, because simply you cannot afford to be unemployed and going to a football ground now, yeah. You know, so you aren't going to get that demographic, you know, the disaffected aren't going to find their way into football stadiums, and you know, so it's not being given that national platform to say, look, these people are angry about something. What are they angry about? But back then, yeah, everything permeated through society into football, and it was all to do with the economics of the country, the economics of the game, and the result was that, you know, it was so sensationalised, it'd be splashed across the front of tabloids, it would be discussed on the news, it would make question time in Parliament and everything, and it seriously was just this massive projection of day-to-day life being played out on, you know, high streets or football stadiums. And it doesn't mean, though, as well at the same time, is that it was always like that. You know, these were still relatively, you know, small number of flashpoints, you know, here and there. You know, it wasn't every game. You know, Heysel, you know, I'm sure we'll come to it, it needs a podcast of its own.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, that was just so uncharacteristic of the Liverpool support at the time. It was not, you know, a reflection of the support that we were, everyone knew. You know, we were one of the most peaceful set of supporters going. You know, they'd go, they'd enjoy football, they would, yeah, there'd be instances of, you know, unrest, there would be, you know, yeah, shoplifting would take place, things like that. You know, I remember stories of kind of like sports shops being emptied, but it was deemed to be, you know, any kind of unrest was deemed to be against the institutions, rather than one another or contemporary supporters. You know, they would defend themselves, they would fight, but if they felt that they were being under threat themselves. You know, they weren't fight starters. They were fight enders, but they wouldn't start a fight. They would end a fight. That was the concept, and that was what made it all so surprising. You know, what happened in Brussels, so shocking and so uncharacteristic. You know, but again, this is such a and that year 85 was so frightening, and that was the epicenter of everything. You know, you can throw in the Luton Millwall game, you can throw in Bradford, you can throw in Ian Hambridge at St Andrews. It was awful, and it was just a projection of everything that this country was about, though.
Yeah, I would just sort of look at the way the establishment government and the ruling party elite of the time reacted to football, and obviously there was a massive issue with police and how football fans were policed, and so many fans were, if you were a football fan, you were stereotyped as being a hooligan, whether you were or not, was almost immaterial. And so I'm going to put this to you, Stu. Do you think that sort of reaction solved the problem or made it worse?
It made it worse. I mean, everything was about containment. You know, there was no, until we get to the Taylor report, there was no real plan, there was no real long-term strategy for, you know, the improvement of the welfare of football fans. You know, and Stephen's right, you know, if you're looking at 40, 50,000 fans, you didn't have 40 or 50,000 hooligans, you probably had 100, you know, a couple of hundred maybe at the most. And the rest of them, you know, were peaceful football fans, but they were just, you know, Steve was right, they were just lumped in together. Or you said, sorry, Gary, you know, a football fan was a hooligan, and that was the association made at the time. And this, like I said before, this containment, this squeezing almost the life out of a football fan, the, you know, the journey to the game, everything was so regimented, there was no freedom. And Stephen made a great point when, you know, he talked about Ken Bates and the electric fences. I mean, I obviously, like you mentioned earlier, I teach at a college, and the students are fascinated by the state of the game when I was a kid. You know, they cannot get their heads around what it was like. And, you know, it was awful. You went because you loved the game, but, you know, the terraces that you stood on, the toilets that you went to, if you went, you know, and the game was played out in the most horrific of environments, and chairman and club owners,
you know better, though. That's the thing, you know better, you know different.
Yeah,
no one knew any different.
No,
this was the way that these grounds were. You know, people who went on kind of like the football special trains that were, you know, that weren't fit for habitation, you know, you wouldn't have put hens in them. You really wouldn't, you know. And it was the, you know, the police barricades that you would have to get through to get to grounds. It was the police dogs. It was the air of suspicion, and it was just ugly.
It was, it makes for great television, and it makes for great news reporting, and it makes for great sensationalism. You know, you only need probably 10 seconds of, you know, an army of fans being marched with police dogs at the side and horses at the front, you know, going into grounds, and, you know, you have your story, you have your, you know, what can't speak can't lie, you know, and there are the images. But within that strip of fans, you know, the majority of them were, you know, were good, well-behaved, law-abiding fans who just wanted to go to a game of football. And yet, because of the way it was squeezed, and then you were herded into pens like animals, you know, like, again, you know, my students can't get their heads around that you were just behind fences and you were made to stand.
Cages, yeah.
Yeah, you were just made to stand in cages.
That started at children, because the, you know, the notorious boys' pens of Anfield and Goodison, and they were cages, you know, up in the top corner of the cop, up in the top corner of the Gladys Street, you know, there were wire fences, and, you know, kids in there, and fights would break out amongst the kids from different schools and all of that kind of stuff, and it was a feral environment. You know, I didn't go into them. You know, I was lucky enough that my dad, you know, when he'd take me, you know, we'd go into the cop, or we'd go down to the Anfield Road end, or, you know, if you had a few extra pennies, we'd go up in the main stand or the paddock, and you know, but I could see it, and I thought, man, for the grace of God, I'm not in there. You know.
It is, and yeah. if you continually put people in that environment. And you know, if you don't invest in your facility, you don't invest in your ground, and you know you're quite happy to, you know, to let it. I mean, you know, you only need to look at Hillsborough and what's come out from there, and the amount of safety violations that were perpetuated by the, you know, the Hillsborough, the ground, you know, and the lack of care and consideration that was given to fans who went to the game. Everything was against the football fan. Everything was. The authorities were, the facilities were, the club owners were. Nobody was on the side of the football fan, and that was the problem. That was essentially the main problem. Nobody believed in them.
It was basically the football fan against everyone who ran and contained the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. We're talking in there, guys, and I'm conscious we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I just want to throw this one to you, Stevie. And you mentioned there about the football fans being on their own, isolated against the powers that be, and obviously the Thatcher government at the time, they sought to marginalise football fans and actually describe football fans as a slum game watched by slum people. And there was the call to bring in ID cards, football fans, and they tried to set up a war cabinet for football. And obviously then we had the tragedies of Bradford, Highstall and Hillsborough, which brought the problem of and the politics to a head. So, sort of just moving on briefly, Stevie, what are your thoughts around that area?
Yeah, it was just symptomatic of the era. You know, you had a Conservative MP as the chairman of Luton Town who banned away fans. You know, he introduced ID cards for getting into the grounds. You know, he made Luton Town basically what Thatcher wanted to make football across the board be like. And it was just an uncared for section of society, and it went beyond football. So as we say, you know, that resultant image that football gave, that was how people felt about, you know, life on a day-to-day basis, you know, and they railed against it, you know, companies closing down and moving to different countries, you know, it was, you know, the local factory closing down, jobs disappearing, you know, the miners, you know, Orgreave, you know, you have to look at Orgreave for, you know, the classic confirmation of just how football mirrored life, because Orgreave was like a football, you know, a contrived football riot. You know, it was, and again, South Yorkshire Police were behind that, who were one of Thatcher's, you know, most culpable police forces in the country. But yeah, it couldn't have got any worse.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people who can't remember that era might think today's society is split and marginalised. But you both very very eruditely mentioned about the and described well, this
it
scene
is.
from 40 years ago.
I would compare kind of like now to then in a social manner, yet. What you had back then in the 70s and 80s was a generation that was more willing to react to it. You know, it doesn't happen so much anymore. We do get marches through the centre of London that go, you know, poorly covered by the media. But yeah, there's less of a propensity to protest, I think, across the board.
I mean, politics to me now just seems ever so slightly left and ever so right of centre, whereas back then it was very left and it was very right, and so that causes, you know, dramatic opinion and dramatic reactions and consequences, whereas now politics to me is, like I say, it's ever so slightly either side of central that I don't think people can almost be bothered to rally against it.
I think that swing is still there, but it's more stage managed now. You know, the mainstream political parties are close together. They are left of centre and right of centre, more or less. But, you know, you only have to look at, extremes such as the BNP, you know, the EDL. You know, it's out there. You know, the Labour Party is currently, the leadership of it is as left as it's been since Michael Foot. But within that, there are people who would, you know, happily see, you know, an arm of it break away to form a new SDP almost. So it is there, but it's not allowed to kind of like bring that massive schism through the mainstream. That will never happen again. It's almost like there's a you know, an agreement between the two main political parties that they will never split that far apart to cause, you know, that sense of chaos that was there in the early 1980s ever again.
I guess the difference is today is it's less a philosophical difference, more a subjective difference between a particular issue. Now, just moving forward, I'm going to throw a couple of questions to both of you just to see your thoughts on it. So first to you, Stu, and then I'll pick Steve's thoughts up and afterwards on the same question. So do you think the issues and events around the game that you watched at that time have shaped your views and how you perceive the world now, the world of football now?
It's a great question. I mean, at the time, you live in the present, don't you? So you take everything that, as you're living it at the time, you just take it, and that's what it is, because you are living it live, and so it goes. Looking back now as a 40-year-old, I look back at the game now, and one, I think, how did my mum let me go? Is the first thing I think. Then I think, how would today's youth have survived in that environment, going to watch football, and that sort of almost a protective, almost anaesthetized for me version of the game that you watch now is you know, people talk about like going to the theatre, isn't it? I personally am very grateful that I've seen both sides of what the game has to offer. I think the modern day game is great. There's a lot of positives to it, you know, and it's a lot better for the fans in certain ways. As much as in the 70s and 80s, it would be horrific at times. It would be horrendous, and you know you wouldn't wish it on anyone. You wouldn't want to go back. But I think for me, it everything is of its time, and so it's not changed my view so much of the game. More that it's made me look at the bigger picture of society of when I was growing up and the things that I never realised was happening because I was either too young to understand it, or because you were fed propaganda that you just took what was being told at the time by your parents or the news, if I happened to be in between going out to play, that, you know, that's just how life was. Whereas now it's very much I see the game now as a retrospective look at life and what life was like in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and, you know, and what it's like now. And I'm grateful that I've seen either side of, I suppose, the Premier League is the big cut-off point. That's how I see it.
What an A-plus answer there, Stu. Fantastic answer, mate. A-plus. In fact, A++.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, no, Stu's nailed it there. You know, he's nailed it perfectly. It is, you live in the moment. You do. You know, you might draw breath once upon a time, you know, every now and then, and look back and think, ooh, you know, that was a bit of a, you know, a tricky era, or wow, how did we come through that? But, you know, I don't look back now thinking that I had any nightmares living through that as such. You know, you just got on with it, and it was what it was. And I use that phrase more now than I have done ever. You know, someone will say something about something negative that is happening. You know, a discussion on New Year's Eve, unfortunately, about Brexit, which, you know, could have done without. But, you know, New Year's Eve, for God's sake, and someone brings it up. You know, and they voted for. You know, I voted against. And you know, all my response was to their justification for voting for it was, well, it is what it is, you know, and I couldn't give anything more than that. You know, I disagree with your reasons, but, you know, I respect your right to vote for that. It is what it is, you know, and that's what it, and that's what football was about then. You know, I can remember seeing some, you know, hideous thing. I was at Hillsborough. You know, I saw some frightening things, but, you know, I went to hundreds of games of football, and it wasn't like that every game. You know, it was, you know, these flashpoints were still relatively rare, but yeah, that you just live through them, and, you know, you look back from time to time and think, you know, you take that deep breath, and then, you know, you get on with whatever you're doing today because you're living today. You know, yeah. And that's the only way I can put it.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I'm going to come to Hillsborough now. And I remember Hillsborough specifically because it was my brother-in-law's wedding day, and when the tragedy was taking place. And I remember them saying on the news that X amount of football fans had died. They're not football fans; they're people. You know, and that was a point that the politics of the day had sort of got football fans marginalised. It was almost not subhuman, but almost not quite people. So it almost didn't matter as much because they were football fans. So I mean, in so many ways, Hillsborough seemed to be the event that defined the era. And so many things that that you mentioned, guys, came to head in a tragic way. So fencing, policing, lack of concern for public safety, football fans being marginalised. It's almost a separate class from normal people. So for obvious reasons, Stevie, I'm going to give you first go at this one.
It was the culmination of everything that was wrong with the way football was treated by the authorities. You know, Sheffield Wednesday Football Club didn't have a safety certificate. You know, how could you allow a football club, you know, A, not to have a safety certificate, but B, not have a safety certificate and host an FA Cup semi-final? It was that kind of level of insanity. You know, the man who was the commander, the match day commander, no experience of football matches whatsoever, but there he is commanding, you know, the safety of thousands of people at a football match, not just a football match, but an FA Cup semi-final. You know, people coming in from two different cities and being navigated around the football stadium to get into different sides of the ground. Again, an insane scenario. You know, the FA Cup semi-finals, 1981, Spurs Wolves, there was a similar incident, and luckily no one, everyone came away with their lives intact. And on the back of that, they stopped FA Cup semi-finals taking place there, and Leeds got to the semi-final in 87. Every police authority washed their hands of the potential fixture, so it was sent to West Yorkshire. So from West Yorkshire to South Yorkshire. The nearest police authority that could take it with a big stadium that would be valid for an FA Cup semi-final, and that was why they went back. And there was scares then amongst those who were, spoken to Leeds fans who were on that terrace, and said they were frightened. And the following year, because, again, no one lost their lives in 87, it went back in 88. I was on Leppins Lane in 88, and I was relieved I wasn't in 89. I was happy to be up in the upper, prior to the match, not for what unfolded, because I saw it all unfold beneath me, and it scars me to this day. But it was symptomatically wrong, and it's not just about the government at the time and the ideology and the thoughts about the football fan and the sport itself and being herded into those pens. And it wasn't just a case of saying South Yorkshire Police and their culpability and the press and how that they demonised the support. It was also the FA for allowing it to happen in the first place. There was culpability across the board, and it was the symptomatic build-up of one of the biggest blind eyes ever to be turned, and it was the result of a two decade build up almost.
You mentioned the Wolves Tottenham's semi final. I was at that game with my wife's family, who are all big Wolves fans, and although it wasn't at the Leppins Lane, it was the opposite end. You could see the problems at the other end of the ground. And it's at a football ground, and you guys have been to football grounds as well, so you sense when there's something not right, there's something seriously wrong. And you had that feeling that day. And, I'm not going to claim, even a premonition of something that could happen later, but you knew something was wrong.
So many people.
What you're saying.
It was no surprise when being in the six, and it was frightening. People were frightened of that terrace, of multiple football clubs. People would complain about that specific terrace, and the fact that it was an accident, a hideous accident waiting to happen. And they turned such a blind eye to it.
People's lives were lost because of that, Stevie. Stu, just your thoughts on that, matey.
Stephen's far more. Can put it far more eloquent, like I said, than I can, and obviously was there and lived it, and certainly anything I have to add is of secondary consequence. But I mean, you know, it was the point. It was the pinch point, and I think that loss of light, that it was a culmination of everything we've talked about for the previous almost, you know, sort of 40 minutes, came to a head in on that afternoon at that one game. And had not everything have come, maybe the consequences wouldn't have been quite severe, but everything failed on one day in one game, apart from the FA Cup final. You know, it's arguably the biggest game of the season, of the FA Cup semi-final, and everything failed badly at the same time, you know, and so it led to catastrophic results. What I would say, you know, and Hillsborough's still, and rightly so, you know, a very emotional and emotive subject, but I wouldn't for a minute, you know, want to speak out of turn, but I think that loss of life, as horrific as it is, saved the game, and it's an awful thing to have to do, and it's an awful thing to have to say, and it's almost, you know, a glib statement to make, but I think without that moment, those consequences, the game was that close to, like I said right at the beginning, we were that close to losing the game. I think had Hillsborough not happened, the game would have gone, the game as we know it would have, you know, would have gone as such, and I think it took that moment to rescue the game, and it's a horrific thing to say, and I hope I don't offend anyone by saying it, but it's, you know, that was the moment when actually people started to look outside of football, and instead of looking to blame football and put everything on football, they used football to look at everything that was wrong, and thank God they did.
Yeah, fair comment, Mighty, and it's an extremely poignant point that you make there, and even though today we, you know, we're talking about still some of the Hillsborough injustices, still rankle with any with football fans or decent people of any stripe. Hillsborough is a massive scar on the face of football, but as you say, it's perhaps it was also a turning point as well. So, who were the key characters in the issues at the time of football? So, national team, clubs, players involved, or politicians? Do you think? Stu first.
I think, you know, we look at the Conservative government, and I think, you know, they were a massive part. Stephen's mentioned Ken Bates. You look at the sportsman, you know, Colin Moynihan. I mean, he's the first sports minister I can remember, you know, up until I can remember how he looked, how he spoke, the spitting image puppets, you know, everything about him. And he was literally in real life, he was a puppet. You know, he wasn't for me, he wasn't there for sport and for the, you know, for the benefits of football in this game. He was there. It was just a political move. You know, it was a political position he was given. I would imagine when he was given it, he thought, oh, this is horrendous. You know, and I think, you know, unfortunately, and this is probably why there was such a problem, that the central figures weren't football people, weren't people with a vested interest in football. You had club owners who maybe were in it for the wrong reason. You had people at the FA who were out of touch with the game, were out of touch with fans, were out of touch with what was happening. You had a government who weren't interested in the game, weren't interested in sport, let alone, you know, it wasn't just football. You know, you look at, you know, the sort of the Moscow Olympics and the, you know, and again, Thatcher not, you know, strongly encouraging, you know, the British team not to go. You know, you got the sense that there was no passion for sport, there was no love for sport, and there's certainly no love for football from, you know, the sort of the leading political figures, and certainly the party that was in control at the time and were just coming in. So 79, you know, 80, the Moscow Olympics, you know, you never got the sense that they were there to promote sport and promote the benefits of sport and use sport to alleviate some of these social concerns and social ills that were around at the time. It was just that, oh, well, actually sport is a main contributor, so we'll crush it and we'll try and marginalise it. And that was the problem. You didn't have people who loved the game, loved sport, were passionate for it. You had the wrong people in the wrong jobs for me.
Yeah, fair comment. So, go to you, Stevie. I mean, Stu mentioned a lot of politicians there and how things were going. But was there something more socially deep-rooted that came to a head in that era? So economic decline, social unrest, But was this just the result? Was the problem between society and the government, or football and the government, something that had been brewing for decades?
It was a slow burner, you know. It just rumbled in, you know. Football, yeah, was. I mean, you could go back to kind of, you know, the Burnden Park disaster, the 1946, I think it was. You know, a similar crush to what happened at Hillsborough, and just unheeded. So that concept of the great unwashed going watching this sport, and almost like these people are somewhat disposable. You know, it still goes on now, in that, you know, you can hear a story about 100 people being killed in an explosion in a market in Baghdad, and, you know, people will not even blanch because, you know, it's Muslims. You know, it's someone else. You know, it's someone else that is not, you know, your community, not your people, and that is the type of effect that football fans elicited from government, from people within power, from people within seats of, you know, whether that football governance or political governance. It was this concept of, they are not us, they are not our type of people, you know, we can play this game of risk. And that's simply what it was.
Yeah, fair comment. I'm just going to sort of bring it up to date, and then we can go sort of contrast football today with the football of those times, the political context of those times. So, what about two questions I'm going to put you both. So, what about the money side of it? So, the growing social disconnect potentially between football and traditional fans of the working class, exec boxes, inflated season ticket prices, the Premier League, and other domestic leagues also being sort of inflated prices to go and watch them. Is it driving less affluent fans away? Could this mean the support for lower-ranked clubs, or could it reinvigorate smaller, non-legal or local clubs? And could it be a sort of most like a regeneration for football? Stu?
I think, you know, we've talked about this before. I think now if you want the football experience, if you like, the traditional football experience, I think you need to go down, you know, down the leagues. And that can only be a good thing. I mean, I just, you know, like I say, I teach across now, and I live in Hull, teach across in Grimsby, you know, and I go to, you know, I've been to Blundell Park a couple of times, and it takes me back to Boothby Park, if you like, you know, where Hull City used to play before they moved. And it's, you know, you can still find the football environment, you can still find the football that certainly our generation grew up with. You know, it's there and it exists, but I think that the Premier League, it's a million miles away from first division football that you would watch, you know, when I was growing up, you know, when I was a kid. I'll never be able to afford a season ticket at a Premier League club, certainly won't be able to afford to take, you know, family or anything like that. But yet you look at non-league season tickets and what non-league clubs are trying to do in terms of bringing fans in, you know, and rightly so, they're almost capitalising on, you know, the fact that actually the traditional working class demographic are being priced out of, you know, top level football, and so they're coming down the leagues to try and, you know, find a price point where you can, you know, you can go in at. And, you know, Grimsby Town League 2, you know, is fine. It, you know, it's the football experience. It's not Stamford Bridge, it's not Old Trafford, but it's a football experience, and it's atmosphere, and it's the game, and it's, you know, it's everything that you love. And, you know, I would quite happily take, you know, take a family to, you know, there to watch the game. And I think that's where, if you're trying to instill a love of football, I think that's, for me, that's where I would do it. I would do it at a lower league club, because I think that's where you get the true football vibe, the true football environment, if you like, as opposed to the theatre or the spectacle that is now the Premier League.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, my football childhood, my football education was at Warsaw, Fellows Park, third division stroke, fourth division football. And that's when I fell in love with the game. And I know we touched on this subject in a pod in the past, but I'm not sure I'd fall in love with the game today. it's a different thing entirely to what it was when I was a kid, so coming through and falling in love with the game. Stevie?
No, I don't think I'd fall in love with the game now. at my current age, as a child, I think you clearly would. If I was 8, 9, 10 now, I'd probably still fall in love with the game as I did when I was 8, 9, 10 then. You know, that's a different matter. But if I'd shown no interest in football, you know, if it hadn't been for me, you know, and my interest would be something else, I don't think I'd be picking it up in the mid-40s thinking this is the way to go. This is how I need to spend my time and my disposable cash. It wouldn't happen. Football can still be beautiful. You know, still watch some. It's like watching a very different sport now. The geometric side of it is pretty epic. The speed and of the movement. You know, but a lot of sports are like that. You know, you could watch, Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal batter a ball around a tennis court now. Stick on YouTube and find Borg versus McEnroe, and you are watching something completely different. But it doesn't mean that it isn't, you know, something beautiful. You know, it's a compare and contrast, isn't it? But no, it is far detached. You know, I go to Anfield, and I can remember as a kid going to the main stand entrance, and the coach pulls in, and the players come off the coach. And, you know, I wasn't one to seek autographs, but I could understand those that did. And those that did could, you know, approach the players as they're getting off the coach. Some would ignore them, some would sign, you know, autographs. You know, the players would pull up for training, and they would go to Anfield, and then they would be ferried by bus to Melwood and back. You know, kids could hang around the car park and see their idols and all that kind of stuff. Not anymore. What you have now is a great big huge shutter door in the new main stand, and the coach drives in, the shutter comes down. You know, the kids do not even get to see the players leave the coach, you know, that human interaction. But within that, it's offset by this social media phenomenon. You know, every football club will have some kind of social media output each day to make their players and their club appear human in a way that it cannot do so physically anymore. You know, I can understand part of that is security concerns, but at the same time, something is lost. You know, football teams will go around schools and hospitals and hand out free gifts and things like that. So, you know, it's done in a completely different manner now. You know, but something is lost. That common touch is lost, and something sad about that.
I was going to say, it depends what you're going for, doesn't it? You know, what are you actually going to watch football for? Are you going to watch the very best, the elite level athletes, this supreme athleticism, in which case, yeah, you know, go watch the Premier League. I would argue that there's so much saturation of it on TV, and it's so analysed and overanalysed and regurgitated, and graphics put on top of graphics. And or are you going because of the social interaction, you know, the standing next to the same person you've stood next to, you know, season after season? You know, is it because of the atmosphere? Is it because of the hopes and fears of a lower league club where, you know, maybe this might be our year, we might win promotion, or we might get to the third round of the FA Cup, or we might draw a big club? It depends what you're going for. And I think that dictates, obviously price dictates, but, you know, what are you actually looking for from the game of football? And I think, like you said, depending on when you grow up, and, you know, talk about it, you fell in love with the game for a reason. And for me, it was about the atmosphere and the what you might see and the hope. You know, they say it's the hope that kills you. It's the hope of, I've never supported a top flight team, so I've always relied on hope. But it's, you know, if that's what you're going for, then I think that's where the lower league teams, non-league teams, can certainly capitalise, because there is still that potential for the extended cup run, the potential for a possible promotion. Premier League now is very much a closed shop all round in terms of winners, Champions League, Europa League, the ones who'll struggle and get, you know, and relegated, and then you have that middle block of teams who will never get relegated but probably will never get to crack the top four either. So, you know, there's no real drama anymore. I suppose drama is probably the word I've been looking for the last couple of minutes. If you want drama, you need to, for me, you need to drop down the leagues, yeah, where it's still unpredictable.
I think, Stuart, we've worked together too long, mate, because you've stolen my sort of...
Sorry.
I was going to say here that, you know, I think, because we've looked at political elements with a large P, and almost semi-ignored, not intentionally, but sort of glossed over the political things with a small P, and the social interaction between clubs and fans is very different from the area we're talking about in the 70s and now, and you've captured that very nicely. Now, you both, because you've both sort of been on political football, especially you, Stu.
Love it.
You know what's coming next?
I do.
So the final question, so, and particularly with regard to the era we've been talking about and the political elements involved in that, so the regular closing question is, and I want to put this first to you, Stu, so I'll give Stevie a bit more time because you've had lots of time to consider this one, I'm sure.
I change it every week. Every time we do it, I change my mind.
Yeah. So, can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? Is the political football inevitable? Away you go, Stu.
Absolutely. Wherever you have a large following of people, wherever you have an entity that draws people, an entity that holds social sway and cultural sway, you will always find political influence. You will always look for politicians to tap into that. You will always see them trying to ingratiate themselves within the game, within the fans. It looks awful. You see clips of politicians trying to keep the ball up or playing with school kids, and you can spot a mile off a naturally interested person who is interested in the game and somebody who is using it for propaganda, and unfortunately, because of whether we like it or not, football is a massive, massive part of the culture, the very fabric of culture and society in this country, and so it's absolutely inescapable, in my opinion.
Yeah. Stevie?
Oh, completely. It's, wherever you look, you could pick out the political aspects of football everywhere, whether that's party political or, just grassroots or anything like that. You could look at, protests at Liverpool that I took part in, Walk on 77. There was this concept that there was going to be, for the following season, one price bracket, particularly the upper price bracket, was going to be £77 just for a seat at a football match. This wasn't everyone was going to pay this, but this was just a symbolic number, and everyone's like, £77. Seriously, what do you get for your £77? What suite am I going to get in? What do I get for myself? And it was simply the highest priced regular ticket of what they were projecting to sell for the following season, and we had this game against Sunderland, I think it was, and the concept was that on the 77th minute, get up and go. And not everyone did it, but a huge amount did, and I was proud to be one of those. And we got up and went. And I know a friend of mine, Keith, and he didn't go. And I remember the very next game, and it made a difference because Liverpool changed the pricing structure for the following season on the back of that protest. And in a way, it was kind of like the starting point for the protest that the FSF picked up and eventually laid the foundations for the concept that away tickets in the Premier League would have a price limit of £30, that couldn't go above £30. And that in itself, that alone was a political movement, and that's the supporters. So the concept of the governing bodies of football teams, of football clubs, the ruling junta of the FA or the Premier League, whatever you want to call them, down to the fans itself. Football cannot be anything other than living side by side, walking hand in hand with politics in some way or another.
Yeah, I mean that's fantastic, guys. I've had a ball sitting here. I've just cracked the second beer and listened to you guys talk. So that's been really enjoyable. So massive thanks to Stevie for joining us on the Political Football. Thank you, Steve.
No problem. A joy as ever.
Thank you, matey. And Stu, I'll dust your seat off next to me for next time, matey.
Yes, please. There's far too much pressure in this seat. I'm not convinced by this position.
Okay. And that's the first episode of Series 2 of the Political Football. And moving forward, the next few episodes, we'll be spreading our wings and flying across the globe to discover the interaction between football and politics around the world. So thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks, and good evening.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.